Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit and nonpartisan forum open to the public. To attend a Commonwealth Club event, check out our program listing at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now we join today's program of the Commonwealth Club.
Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm John McMahon, the club's quarterly chair. We also welcome our listeners on the radio and remind everyone that you can find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Amory Levins, co-founder and CEO of the Rocky Mountain Institute and expert in the field of alternative energy. Amory considers himself as an experimental physicist, which I think is a really an understatement of all the things that he can do. He was educated at Harvard and Oxford. He advises the energy and other industries for 30 years, as well as other industries and various government agencies. Since 1990, he has led a move to alternative sources of powering automobiles, focusing on hydrogen as an alternative to fossil fuels. He's written many books. One of the two that seemed to be most appropriate tonight, Natural Capitalism was one, and Small is Profitable, the Hidden Economics Benefits of Making Electrical Resources the Right Size. The latter book won the Economist magazine Top 3 Business and Economics Books in 2002. He's a member of the Society of Automotive Engineers, the American Physical Society, the International Association of Energy Economics. He's a fellow at the American Association for the Advancement of Science and at the World Academy of Arts and Sciences, World Business Academy. Newsweek said of Amory, one of the Western world's most influential energy thinkers. The Wall Street Journal said, one of 39 people most likely to change the world. It gives me great pleasure to introduce Amory as our speaker tonight.
Thank you, and my thanks to the Commonwealth Club for the privilege of introducing some work that my team actually published in September 2004, and it's been evolving rapidly since then. It's encapsulated in a book called Winning the Oil Endgame, Innovation for Profits, Jobs, and Security, and you can get the whole thing free at oilendgame.com as a download. It's an independent, peer-reviewed study that's survived well, some very intense scrutiny since we published it. It was co-sponsored by the Office of the Secretary of Defense and the Chief of Naval Research and written for business and military leaders. I wrote it around competitive strategy business cases for five sectors: cars, trucks, planes, oil, and military. And it has an arrestingly simple thesis that over the next few decades, that is by the 2040s, the U.S. can be completely off oil with a much stronger economy led by business for profit. There is some economic history supporting such a radical shift in a fundamental commodity. It happens all the time with technological progress. In fact, the last time it happened in energy in the sort of pattern I'm interested in here was with whaling, the fifth biggest industry in the country in 1850. And at that time, essentially all our houses were lit by whale oil. But as whales got shy and scarce, the price of whale oil went up and competitors started coming in. Two in particular, gas and oil, both made from coal. They took over 5/6 of the whale oil lighting market away just in the 9 years before Drake struck oil in Pennsylvania in 1859. The whalers were astonished. They hadn't seen this coming because they hadn't paid attention to competition, and they never expected to run out of customers before they ran out of whales. But that's what happened. The remaining whales were saved by technological innovators and profit-maximizing capitalists, and the whalers were soon reduced to begging for federal subsidies on national security grounds. Now, the transition beyond oil has two main parts. The first is to save half the oil by redoubling the efficiency of using it. We've already doubled our productivity of using oil, our GDP per barrel since 1975, but we can double it again at an average cost, it turns out, of $12 per saved barrel. The other half of the oil we can replace with a combination of saved natural gas and a slightly smaller quantity of advanced biofuels, and those have an average cost of $18 a barrel. So to get off oil completely costs an average of, let's see, 12 and 18, half and half, so that's $15 a barrel, which is a quarter what we're paying today, or a fifth what we've paid lately. You start to see how this gets to be profitable. And let us suppose for the moment that we actually embark on this journey, and by 2025, we've invested $180 billion once, half of it to retool the car, truck, and plane industries, half of it to build a modern biofuels industry. And suppose that the oil that these activities save or displace only costs 26 bucks a barrel, which was the official forecast of 2 years ago. In that case, we would then be saving over $150 billion a year gross, $70 billion a year net, a very handsome net return on a $180 billion investment. We would get 1 million new jobs, three-quarters of them in rural and small-town America. We would get to save 1 million jobs now at risk, mainly in automaking, where we have a really simple choice. Do we continue importing efficient cars to save oil, or do we make efficient cars and import neither the oils nor the cars? So there's 1 million jobs hanging in that balance. But this sort of thing actually works, and we know because we've done it before. The last time we paid attention to oil in the United States was from 1977 to 85, and in those 8 years, the economy grew 27%. Oil use shrank 17%. Oil imports fell by 50%. Imports from the Persian Gulf fell by 87%. They would have been gone in one more year if we'd kept that up. And in fact, the amount of oil used in the world shrank so much that it cut OPEC's exports in half, and it broke their pricing power for a decade because it turned out we customers had more market power than the oil supply cartel. But our market power is on the demand side. We are the Saudi Arabia of mega barrels, and we can save oil faster than they can conveniently sell less oil. Well, we could rerun that old play all over again a lot better because we have much more powerful technologies. And indeed, they are so profitable that they can be implemented without new fuel taxes, subsidies, mandates, federal laws, or anything else that either political party doesn't like or could mess up. The transition is driven instead by business logic. Now, the technologies are very important, and the most important are in transportation, which uses 70% of our oil. Fortunately, we can triple the efficiency of cars, trucks, and planes with respective paybacks on their extra cost of roughly 2 years, 1 year, and 4 or 5 years, respectively, at today's fuel prices. And the basic strategy is the same for all three kinds of vehicles. Namely, you make them lighter weight, more streamlined and slippery in moving through the air and along the road, and with advanced propulsion systems. This will often also give you improved performance. For example, an ultralight carbon fiber diesel hybrid roadster that Opel came up with can do 155 miles an hour and 94 miles a gallon, although not at the same instant. And the delightful surprise is that the ultralighting, for example, with carbon fiber, that takes away half the weight and half the fuel use of cars and light trucks with better safety and no extra cost, is like finding a Saudi Arabia under Detroit, and yet it doesn't cost more to make those cars, because the advanced materials that cost more to be so light and strong are offset by simpler automaking and a smaller propulsion system. More about that in a minute. But it may be contrary to a lot of your assumptions, because people who make cars or car policy have always assumed that if you want cars to be much more efficient, they have to be squinchy, sluggish, unsafe, ugly, costly, and you wouldn't really want to buy one. So the only issue is, does the government get you to buy one anyway through stiff gasoline taxes or car efficiency standards? that's been a 20-year gridlock in Congress, so nothing's happened. But why is it that we changed from vinyl phonograph records to digital media, or from cathode ray tube televisions to flat panel televisions? It isn't because somebody told us to do it. It's because it was a superior product that redefined our expectations. So the approach I've always had to car efficiency is to make it a byproduct of breakthrough engineering that will make you want to buy the car because it's better, not because it's efficient. And then the automakers have a much more robust business model because they only need to worry about whether they're making better and cheaper cars than their rivals and not about random variables like oil price or public policy. Well, it turns out you can actually triple the efficiency of cars without extra cost and without compromise by just understanding the physics of a car. Typically, your car uses every day 100 times its weight in ancient plants. It very inefficiently converted to gasoline. However, 7/8 of that precious energy never reaches the wheels. It's lost in the engine and idling and driveline and accessories. And of the 1/8 that does reach the wheels, half of that heats the tires and road or heats the air that the car pushes aside. Only the last 6% of the original fuel energy actually accelerates the car and then heats the brakes when you stop. And since only about 5% of the mass you're accelerating is the car, is the driver, 95% is the car, you can take 5% of 6%, and you conclude that about 0.3% of the original fuel energy ends up moving the driver. This is not very gratifying after 120 years of devoted engineering effort. But the good news is that 3/4 of the energy it takes to move the car is actually caused by its weight. And every unit of energy you can save at the wheels saves another 7 units you don't need to waste getting it to the wheels. So there is enormous leverage in making the car radically lighter weight. This used to mean just light metals like aluminum, magnesium, titanium, which work fine. I drive an aluminum hybrid, but they're fairly expensive. Now it can also mean new ultralight steels that are a lot cheaper. And the stiffest and strongest solution is carbon fiber composites like we use in sporting goods. Those are so strong that at the front end of a Mercedes SLR McLaren, which is kind of a street-licensed Formula One $500,000 handmade car from carbon fiber, you'll find inside a pair of woven carbon fiber crush cones, and they weigh a total of 15 pounds, which is 0.4% as much as the car, and yet that's enough to absorb the entire crash energy of this car hitting a wall at 65 miles an hour, because these materials can absorb 6 to 12 times as much crash energy per pound as steel and can do so more smoothly. That means that we've solved the riddle of how can you be safe in a car that's a lot lighter than a lot of other things on the road, because with these exceptionally strong materials designed right, you can make a car that's big, therefore protective and comfortable, without also making it heavy, which is hostile and inefficient. Therefore, you can save lives and oil and indeed dollars all at the same time. We don't need weight for strength. Henry Ford was very clear about that, and then we forgot. And if we did need weight for strength, your bicycle helmet would be made out of steel, but probably it's actually made out of carbon fiber. Now, the problem is cost, because in the military and aerospace uses where we apply these advanced composites, we have about 1,000 times lower production volume and higher cost than you would need for mass-market cars. But I got encouraged about bridging that huge gap when I met a young engineer at the Lockheed Martin Skunk Works who in the mid-90s had led the design of an advanced fighter plane airframe that was 95% carbon fiber, one-third lighter, but two-thirds cheaper, because he did a clean sheet design, no preconceptions, based on how to manufacture it optimally out of carbon fiber, not metal. Well, it was so weird he couldn't find a military customer for it, so he quit, and one bounce later I was able to hire him to do the same thing for cars, and we did. And what we ended up with in 2000, working with a couple of European Tier 1 engineering firms, was your basic uncompromised 3.5-fold more efficient mid-size suburban assault vehicle. It's a very attractive SUV that would handle 5 adults in comfort, 69 cubic feet of cargo. It could haul a half ton up a 44% grade, and different variants of it would do 0 to 60 in about 7 or 8 seconds and get 67 miles a gallon on gasoline with a Prius-like hybrid propulsion system, or 114 miles a gallon with a hydrogen fuel cell. By the way, the hybrid version would cost an extra $2,500 sticker price compared to the nearest steel vehicle today. How do we know? Well, we took an almost 500 line item bill of materials and had our Tier 1 partner put it out to bid to the supply chain to ask what would the suppliers charge to make $50,000 a year, and then we added it all up. Now, the big breakthrough here is not just in efficiency, but in manufacturing, because that SUV would have only 14 parts in the body, each liftable with one hand and no hoist, and each makeable with one low-pressure die set. A normal steel auto body like that would have 10 or 20 times more parts, each requiring about 4 progressive steel die sets to stamp it gradually into the right shape. And that means you just saved about 99% on tooling cost. And then because the parts snap precisely together for gluing, kind of like a kid's toy, you don't need jigs, robots, and welders. The body shop went away. You can lay color in the mold, then you don't need the paint shop either. So there went the two costliest and most difficult parts of making the car. And therefore, you need at least 2/5 less capital investment than the leanest plant in the industry. There is actually a manufacturing solution for these materials now that a little company I chair has developed to declare an interest. I'm a tiny shareholder in it. And it lets you make automatically a flat kind of plywood of carbon fiber in layers pointing in different directions to be stiff and strong in the directions you want and not otherwise, embedded in a thermoplastic like nylon. And then since that's that gets soft when you heat it up, you just heat it till it softens, put it on a hot die, and in 30 to 60 seconds mold it to the shape you want. I brought along a little bowl made like that. It's about the size of a big cantaloupe, but with a very thin shell, incredibly light. And I'll just hit it so that you can hear what sound it makes. Does kind of ring like a bell, so that tells you how incredibly stiff it is, and it's tougher than titanium. So plastics have changed since that 60s film, The Graduate. And there are a number of automakers and aerospace companies and others getting quite active in this realm. In fact, half of the weight of a new Boeing Dreamliner is made of advanced composite, although in more expensive ways suitable for aerospace. And actually, in that SUV design, 2/3 of the fuel saving is for making it ultralight. That's 4 times as important as making it hybrid electric. Now, there are similar innovations that we worked out in detail for trucks, planes, and indeed every use of oil, including in buildings and industry. But let me turn for a moment to the supply side. What do we do with the other half of the oil that we didn't save? About 3/5 of that remaining oil gets substituted by saved natural gas. Saving natural gas is not something that our government thinks about, it seems, because they have plans to have lots of liquefied natural gas terminals bringing in more imported gas from the sorts of countries we know and love. Those are not only very expensive and vulnerable and controversial, they're unnecessary because half our gas can be saved at about 1/8 or 1/10 of its current price. And 2/3 of the gas savings can be done in the electricity sector, where we make our peak power extremely inefficiently out of natural gas. In simple cycle combustion turbines, they're so inefficient that if you save 1% of the electricity in the country, including peak hours, you thereby save 2% of all the natural gas in the country and cut its price about 3 or 4%. So there's huge leverage there. And then the rest of the oil would get displaced by advanced biofuels. I do not mean by that corn-based ethanol, which, although it's improving, is still a rather small and costly and heavily subsidized resource. Rather, I'm talking about cellulosic ethanol and the like. Cellulosic means it's made out of woody, weedy plants like switchgrass and poplar and crop wastes and forestry wastes. And it turns out that this requires less investment than corn ethanol. It gives you up to 8 times better net energy yield and about twice the yield of product. And we can get a lot of that stuff, 4 million barrels a day, without even using cropland, just by growing things like switchgrass on conservation reserve land. And because the switchgrass and its relatives are perennial prairie grasses with very deep roots, they hold the soil even better than the cover crops we're using now. Biofuels are starting to mature nicely. Brazil has replaced over 2/5 of its otherwise required gallons of gasoline already with sugarcane ethanol that's very competitive without subsidy. They'd love to sell it to us, but they can't because of an illegal 100% tariff we put on to protect our corn farmers. Sweden has a plan for getting completely off oil by 2020 based mainly on forestry wastes. And Europe is a much bigger producer than we are of biodiesel as part of their strategy to move farmers off of temporary subsidies onto durable revenues. But when you put all the pieces together of efficiency, advanced biofuels, saved natural gas, you find that there is, even by 2025, when we haven't yet completed the turnover of the vehicle fleets, there is almost enough of that stuff to displace all of our oil. And soon after that, as we complete the fleet turnover, we get off oil altogether in the 2040s. Now, there are even some ways to do better than that. For example, I've assumed here that we just burn the saved natural gas as a fuel, but you can make even more money turning it into hydrogen, which you can use 2 or 3 times more efficiently than hydrocarbon. If you did that, it would obviously be worth more, and you could also, of course, make it in other ways. For example, there's enough available windy land in the Dakotas to make enough hydrogen to run every highway vehicle in the country at these levels of efficiency. And although hydrogen is not necessary for getting us off oil, it would be very well justified in business terms once you've got those efficient vehicles, partly because the hydrogen storage tanks for normal driving range get 3 times smaller. They get so small that off-the-shelf tank technology will carry you many hundreds of miles and still leave plenty of room for people and cargo. And the fuel cell itself gets 3 times smaller, so you can pay 3 times more per kilowatt. And that cuts 1 or 2 decades off the deployment time because you need about 30 times less production volume to get the price down far enough to compete. Now, because these activities I've described are so profitable, we are not envisaging they're being driven by public policy forcing people to do unnatural acts in the marketplace. But it would be nice if public policy would support and not distort the underlying business logic. And therefore, we've come up with an innovative slate of policies to help do that. The most important of them is to get very efficient cars and light trucks on the road in larger numbers and sooner. And it's not a gasoline tax. It's not an efficiency standard. It's something better than either of those called a feebate, which is a cross between a fee and a rebate. When you go to the dealer to buy a vehicle of the size you want, there will be more and less efficient models. So let's charge a fee on the less efficient ones according to how inefficient they are and use that money to pay a rebate to buyers of the more efficient models. And therefore, within each size class, we're going to widen the price spread so that you will take account when you buy that vehicle of its full life cycle savings over, say, 14 years rather than just the first couple of years as now. So your investment choice will be efficient for society. And by the way, the automakers make more money this way. You're not being encouraged to buy a different size vehicle than you want, but within that size class, you are being encouraged to buy a more efficient one. And this very much changes, of course, what automakers offer because they have a strong incentive to get out of the fee zone into the rebate zone. We also address the issue of many millions of American households not having enough money to buy an efficient car and therefore not able to get to work. If, for example, African American households had the same car ownership as white households, That would cut the employment disparity roughly in half. It's a big deal socially. And we found that by creative financial engineering, somewhat akin to the structure of student loans, we could, at very low or no cost, get a low-income household into an extremely efficient, reliable new car they can afford to run. Well, let's then couple that with scrapping inefficient old cars to get them off the road and clean up the air faster. And the combination is a new million-car-a-year market for Detroit that they weren't going to get otherwise because these are not creditworthy customers, so they like that idea. We found some ways to do smarter procurement by local and state and national governments and by the military, and ways like the Automotive XPRIZE to speed innovation from lab to showroom. In the case of heavy trucks, what was missing turned out to be just information to the market actors. In the case of airplanes, the legacy airlines have about half their cost problem from inefficient planes, but they can't afford to replace them with efficient new ones. So we came up with a way to do loan guarantees for that purpose without a net cost to the Treasury. And at the same time, we're going to scrap the inefficient old planes so they won't go back in the air, waste more oil, and block the adoption and development of triple deficiency new models. In other words, the inefficient old planes are worth more dead than alive, so let's take them out back and shoot them. There is a major role here for military R&D. Remember, that's what created the precursors of the Internet, the global positioning system, the jet engine industry, the microchip industry. Well, here, the military has a very strong motivation to trim its fat, vulnerable, costly fuel logistics tail that it drags around with it because its platforms are so fuel inefficient. We have two-star generals of Western Iraq now begging for efficiency and renewables to untether them from oil because they can't do their job if they're having to spend so much time guarding fuel convoys from being blown up. They'd rather not have the convoys. The best way to beat those roadside bombs is not to be there. And as the military works on, for example, ultralight materials and cheap ways to make them into structures, that can transform the civilian car, truck, and plane industries and therefore lead the civilian economy, 60 times bigger than the Pentagon's oil purchases, off oil, so the Pentagon needn't fight over oil. They can have nega missions in the Gulf, mission unnecessary, and they think that's a really neat idea. We've also found some ways to retool and retrain the automakers that have weak balance sheets and speed the shift from hydrocarbons to carbohydrates and generally get out of our own way. These kinds of changes do take time, especially when it takes 14 years to turn over the car stock. But let's remember that in the 1920s, American automakers took 6 years to switch from wood to steel auto bodies. And at the start of World War II, it took them 6 months to switch completely from making cars to making the stuff that won the war. That was, of course, under wartime mobilization, which I'm not calling for. Maybe I should be. When you realize that two-thirds of Saudi oil flows through one processing plant that's already been attacked and two terminals, the larger of which has already been attacked twice. I don't know how long we can go on being lucky. but if you don't have a wartime mobilization, it normally takes about 12 to 15 years with a technology diffusion kind of S-shaped curve to go from 10 to 90% adoption, and we figured out how to cut several years off getting to that takeoff point. I am encouraged that when we last paid attention to oil from 77 to 85, we were saving the equivalent of a Persian Gulf's worth of imports every 2.5 years. And if 19 years from now, in 2025, every light vehicle were only as efficient as the best cars and SUVs that were in the showrooms in 2004, they would save twice as much oil as we get today from the Persian Gulf. So let me conclude just by summarizing where we are with implementation, because Rocky Mountain Institute is almost halfway through a 3-year, $4 million effort to make all this happen irreversibly by what you might call institutional acupuncture. That means we figure out where the business logic is congested and not flowing properly. We stick a needle in it to help it flow. We didn't need to do anything to help aviation because Boeing is already using this strategy and beating the pants off Airbus with it. They're doing just fine, thank you. They have a new airliner, a 787, that uses a fifth less fuel, costs the same, works better. Walmart is the leader in heavy trucks. Based on our analysis, they have demanded from their suppliers that their fleet efficiency for their 18-wheelers be doubled by 2015. The suppliers are most of the way through figuring out how to do that. Then everybody will be able to buy those doubled efficiency trucks. That'll save 6% of all the oil in the country. After that, there's tripled efficiency. The military is emerging rapidly as the federal leader in getting the country off oil. There's a great deal of interest in fuels and in the financial sector. The clean energy space in 2006 is getting $63 billion of private capital. And we always knew that the hardest, slowest sector would be cars and light trucks. But notice who's the new CEO of the Ford Motor Company? Alan Mulally was head of Boeing Commercial Airplanes. He's the one that led that strategy of beating Airbus with an efficiency leapfrog based on making half the airplane out of advanced composites to take the weight out. He knows how to do that. That DNA has now been injected into Detroit. Watch this space. United Auto Workers and the dealers are crying out for this kind of innovation to save our auto industry. And I've had discussions in Detroit in the last few years as they go through what the economist Joseph Schumpeter called creative destruction, where old industries go away, new ones come up, and this market will change either the managers' minds or the managers, whichever happens first. And I found them very open to radical new possibilities. I think gazing into the abyss does concentrate the mind wonderfully. So there is, if you have your ear to the ground, you can hear the tectonic plates creaking all the way from Detroit. So what are we waiting for to get off oil? Well, we're the people we've been waiting for. And if you think all this sounds too good to be true, just remember that remark of Marshall McLuhan, who said, "Only puny secrets need protection. Big discoveries are protected by public incredulity." Thank you very much.
Our thanks to Amory Lovins, co-founder and CEO of Rocky Mountain Institute, expert in the field of alternative energy, and co-author of Winning the Oil Endgame, for his comments here today. My name is Kerry Curtis. I'm the chair of the Commonwealth Club's Environment and Natural Resources Forum, and I'm the moderator for today's audience question period. Mr. Lovins, we have a large number of questions from our audience, so let's get to them. In your earlier book, Natural Capitalism, you described the concept of the hypercar. And could you talk about how would that concept be different today than it was in 1999 when you published that book? And when could we buy one?
Well, the only difference from, say, 2000, when we did that hyper SUV design, if you wish, 3.5 times more efficient and 2-year payback, which, by the way, is because it's hybrid, not because it's ultralight. The ultralighting is free. The only difference is that now we actually have a manufacturing process to make it with. And if for any reason the advanced composites were not ready for prime time, ultralight steels can save 80-odd percent as much fuel at a roughly comparable cost per gallon. So the market will sort out which materials win. I would put my own bet on the advanced composites because they have strategic advantages in manufacturing, but I'm materials neutral, and it's nice to know that there's a way to do most of the same job with steel because everybody knows how to make cars out of steel, so that's a backstop technology. Now, the history of the concept is pretty simple. I figured out around 91 that if you made cars very light and slippery and hybrid electric and radically simplified and software-dominated and highly integrated design, they would get incredibly efficient but cost about the same to make. And then spent several years with GM validating the concept. And in 93, I put the concept to the public domain so nobody could patent it. Got a lot of folks fighting over it. By 2000, the industry had committed about $10 billion to this general line of development. But when we tried to get into the market to produce such cars, the capital market collapsed at that moment, November 2000. Bad timing. But then the automakers came back to us and said, oh, well, now we look at your design. We see it's absolutely essential that we make cars this way. We just don't know how. We don't have an affordable way to manufacture them. Could you show us a process that worked and makes us some parts? So in mid-2003, we stood up an engineering center to do that. The process worked. And for the past couple of years, the auto industry has been finding out about it, and we now have a number of automakers among the customers of that little spinoff called FiberForge.
Thank you. Next question has to do with hydrogen. In the book, Winning the Oil Endgame, you talk a lot about hydrogen as the long-run best option. But if you looked at a joint goal of both achieving energy independence and reducing global warming, would hydrogen still be an attractive option?
Very much so. And that and other questions you might have in mind about hydrogen are addressed in a white paper widely used in the industry called 20 Hydrogen Myths, which you can download free from rmi.org, then library, then energy, and then fuel cells and hydrogen. The short answer is if you made your hydrogen out of natural gas, as we make 96% of our hydrogen today for industry, and you didn't stop the carbon from going in the air, you would still be emitting 2 to 6 times less carbon per mile than you are right now because the hydrogen is used so much more efficiently and natural gas has less carbon in it than gasoline does. But, of course, you would like over the longer run to transition to renewable hydrogen that releases no carbon or to control the carbon coming out of your little four-quart reformer at the gas station, and it appears that, too, will be attractive.
Thank you. Next question has to do with a kind of a frustration question, which is that your ideas are so powerful and so persuasive. Why are things taking so long? Why is the car industry so slow, the federal government, so forth?
Well, we're in a tripolar society where the foci of action and power are really business, civil society, and government in order of decreasing effectiveness, at least if you talk about national government. So I've never spent much time in Washington. I tend to work with the private sector, which is much more dynamic, and especially in its interplay with civil society, whether that relationship is adversarial or collaborative. And I'm very excited by how quickly you can get things done that way instead of waiting for Congress to do something. In fact, when we were about to publish the book, I did a pre-brief on Capitol Hill for the staffers, both houses, both sides. We're very apolitical at RMI. And when I got through, the most senior Republican president said, I'm really glad you're not coming up here to ask us to do something because we would just mess it up. Well, these things take time mostly because we're dealing with very large, ponderous institutions, and the problems are mainly cultural, not technical or economic, although in the automaker's defense, remember that they didn't have a validated process for making these automotive structures affordably till the last 1.5 or 2 years. So it's early days for them to adopt that. But I'm actually amazed by how quickly things are moving. I asked a very senior person in Detroit just over a year ago, what would you do if you became convinced there is a strategically advantageous new way to make cars, but it would require you to abandon your steel stamping capacity? And to my delight, he looked me in the eye and said, we would adopt it immediately and fearlessly. That's the right answer. When you have that disruptive a technology, you got to do it first and sell your steel stamping equipment to your competitors to slow them down. But I'm sure that he would not have given me that answer 6 or 12 months earlier.
Great, great answer. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our speaker today is Amory Lovins, co-founder and CEO of Rocky Mountain Institute, who is discussing our dependence on oil and the potential for alternative forms of energy. You partially answered the next question, which has to do with Congress. And I probably don't even need to ask this question, but what potential is there with a new Congress for some kind of leadership that may propel us a little faster in these directions? And in particular, is there any potential for taxes, moving the tax burden from income tax onto a fuel tax on the one hand, and perhaps the CAFE standards on the other?
Well, that's been a durable gridlock for a quarter century. Maybe it'll change. Don't hold your breath. Fee baits are a lot more powerful. They are definitely a moneymaker for the industry, and they're starting to pop up at state level. And in fact, they make so much sense and so much money that the California legislature around 1991 or thereabouts approved them by a 7-to-1 margin. Imagine that in any legislature. Now, the governor pocket vetoed it, and it's been bottled up ever since. But it's going to come back. And I think it is quite right that in such a big, diverse country, that sort of mechanism should be piloted at a state and regional level before we try it nationally anyway. So I don't mind that Congress doesn't seem ready. And we can do everything required, actually, at a state or administrative level. In fact, just to pick an example, we helped the city council in the District of Columbia adopt something that sort of waddles and quacks like a fee bait. Namely, if you live in the district and buy a new car, there's normally an excise tax, but that tax is reduced to zero if it's a very efficient car, and it's raised a little if you have a very inefficient heavy car because that damages the streets more. That's, of course, quintessentially a local issue that cannot be federally preempted. That's just an example of how a local jurisdiction can take a very constructive action without federal leadership or permission.
Thank you. You've talked about the importance of the lightweight carbon fiber technology and getting to a position of much greater fuel efficiency in transportation. Does that industry, the carbon fiber industry, need some kind of a kickstart, or does it need some kind of a breakthrough like the Bessemer process in steel manufacturing?
None of the above. It's doing very well, thank you. Temporarily, the price of carbon fiber has doubled over the past couple of years because suddenly Boeing started making half its airplane weight in its new airframe and Airbus a quarter out of advanced composites. And it takes a year or two for the carbon fiber makers to catch up. If, of course, we did what we do with other commodities and made futures and options markets, we could even out the price. It wouldn't yo-yo like that, and there wouldn't be so much risk. But that's just a financial mechanism. There's plenty of technology to make the stuff at the prices required. It's, in case you're wondering what it's made out of, typically propane. But, of course, it's always a better deal to invest your hydrocarbons in an ultralight structure that doesn't rust or fatigue and will save enormous amounts of fuel than to blow your hydrocarbon out the tailpipe to haul heavy steel around. If, by the way, you want to, you can always use carbohydrates instead of hydrocarbons. It's just molecules.
This listener is asking, why do you favor hydrogen cell-powered vehicles by so strongly compared to plug-in hybrids?
Oh, I'm quite unbiased about that, and in fact, our institute is now completing the first independent study of plug-in hybrids to figure out where they can make sense. Obviously, you want to do them right. You don't want to recharge them in the daytime where they would burden the distribution capacity of the utilities. But one of the interesting things about them is that you have all this battery power riding around on wheels, and your car is parked about 96% of the time. So if we have a smart grid to plug it into, then in the hottest afternoons in the summer when the utilities are begging for more electricity and willing to pay a lot for it, you may be able to plug your car at its parking place into the grid, sell back your stored power when and where it's most valuable, and earn enough money to help pay for those very expensive batteries. So we're working those numbers now. And by the way, if you did this vehicle-to-grid trick with fuel cell cars, the first 2 million Americans to do that would earn back the entire cost of the car with this little power plant on wheels trick. And if everybody did that, the light vehicles would have 6 to 12 times as much generating capacity as the national grid. So it doesn't take very many people liking this new value proposition to put the coal and nuclear plants out of business.
There's a lot of interest in your ideas, obviously, here in this country, but obviously there must be a lot of interest overseas as well. Are other countries taking these ideas and moving with them more quickly than we are?
Well, yes and no. as you would expect, the Japanese automakers have some aggressive activities going on. In fact, both Toyota and Honda have put their best automotive innovators in charge of their carbon fiber small airplane businesses. Why do you suppose they would do that? Gee, maybe it's not all about airplanes. And China has energy efficiency as its highest priority in its whole national development strategy, and leapfrog technologies. We are the intended leapfroggee. I asked a very senior friend in Detroit recently how long it'll be before you can drive home from Walmart in your new, let's call it a Wally, made by, say, Shanghai Automotive and using very little oil. He said, oh, about 10 years, which is tomorrow in automotive terms. And then I asked him how long before that Wally needs no oil and runs on fuel cells. He said, oh, not a whole lot longer, because the Chinese intend to leapfrog us in fuel cells as well and get off oil that way. They're desperate not to fall into the oil trap we have. And they have excellent R&D going on in this field. They have a whole lot more smart electrochemists than we do. That's a field we've much neglected. And that's why they're the world leaders in lithium-ion batteries. It takes the same discipline, electrochemistry, to make a good fuel cell as a good battery, except the battery's harder. So this is another area. And in fact, I was briefing a very senior group of automotive chief executives at a European meeting about a year ago. And when I was through, one of the German executives was saying the usual skeptical things about carbon fiber cost. And a leading Indian automaker across the table said, well, you should understand not all your competitors are that inhibited. We intend to get Lovins to India straight away to leapfrog our industry. I love that stuff. Competition is good.
There's some talk around about increasing our investment in nuclear energy. And there's a lot of negatives with that, of course. And so do your ideas and these technologies have the potential to prevent us from getting back into nuclear energy?
Well, sure, but there are a lot of reasons to do that anyway, most of all economics. Nuclear is dying of an incurable attack of market forces, and yet the industry, which can hardly make a plant anymore, it's so run down for lack of orders, is somehow managing to create the illusion of vibrant health. Well, look at what's been happening lately. In the United States, Congress voted in 2005 new subsidies on top of the old ones, whereby the next six plants get repaid by the taxpayer roughly their entire capital cost, whereupon Standard & Poor's put out a couple of reports saying this would not materially improve the builders' credit ratings because most of the risks the market is concerned about are still there. So this will have roughly the effect of defibrillating a corpse. It will jump, but it won't revive. And the reason is very simple, that nuclear is hopelessly uneconomic, not only compared to other big power plants, but all of them are uneconomic compared to two other things, micropower and efficiency. Micropower comprises the cogeneration of useful heat and electricity together in industry and buildings. About two-thirds of the cogeneration in the world is gas-fired, so it saves at least half the carbon. And that plus decentralized renewable sources of electricity, which got about $38 billion of investment last year, together make a sixth of the world's electricity, slightly more than nuclear. And last year they made a third of the world's new electricity. Micropower made last year between a sixth and over half of all electricity in 13 industrial countries. These are the competitors that we are often told are slow, small, costly, futuristic. They'll never amount to much. Well, surprise, they plus megawatts electric savings have already taken over half the world market away from central power plants. And that's just because they're cheaper and they have less financial risk. That is why they are financed almost entirely by private risk capital. There isn't a new nuclear project in the world with a cent of private capital at risk. Why should we take the word of central planners in Beijing over that of capitalists in New York? I don't get it. If you take markets seriously, I think you have to pay attention to market behavior.
This listener wants to repeat the website for downloading the book, and I think it's oilendgame.com, is that right?
That's correct. The book is a free download of a bit less than 2 megabytes. And by the way, all of the summaries and press coverage are there, and so are 24 technical annexes with lots of details.
How about shale oil production? Is it cost-effective, and is the water recovery effective in that process?
There's an emerging process that isn't as unattractive as the old ones. I think the jury is out on how expensive it will be and how much water it will take. But I think whether you're talking about oil shale or tar sands or coal syn fuels, which are probably the most expensive, it is hard to imagine how this will come anywhere close, like within a factor 2 or 3 of competing with getting off oil for $15 a barrel. And that's also why I'm not very worried that if we buy that much less oil, the oil price will crash and make our alternatives uneconomic. No, they're so cheap, they'll still be economic. But that is not true of the very costly kinds of alternative supplies that you mentioned.
Some people think that one of the big problems in facing the planet is the rate of growth of human population. And so if we're able to greatly increase the efficiency of energy, will there be a problem that it promotes even more birth rate in the human population?
I think most demographers would tell you it's the opposite. If the 2 billion people with no electricity start getting solar power and efficient light so girls can learn to read at night and all the other basics of a decent life, irrigation pumping, vaccine refrigerators, GPS so they can do land titling and so on, cell phones to double the prosperity of the village in the first year, chances are you will get an even faster demographic transition and faster spread of contraception for women who want it, and a change in the role of women and the role of men, and a lot of the forces, the social forces driving runaway population growth will moderate even faster than they have so far. Of course, the next thing to watch out for is that we don't swallow up the energy efficiency with the even faster economic growth that it makes possible without paying very careful attention to what is growing, who is benefiting, whom is it costing, and who decides. In other words, just as markets make a wonderful servant and a bad master and a worse religion, the same is true of economic growth. We have to use it as a considered tool, not as just an undifferentiated mechanical process that runs away with us and takes us places we don't want to go.
You mentioned Wall Street capitalists being perhaps someone we should listen to compared to central planners. But so where is the venture capital being invested now in this area? What specific kinds of technologies and so forth?
Well, distributed renewables are somewhere in the 40s of billions of dollars of global investment in 2006. They're growing by tens of percent a year. Photovoltaics, for example, are a $7 billion industry. Wind is probably at least a $15 billion industry, maybe closer to 20. And now biofuels in the past year has gotten into that league as well. The main problem, though, as, say, venture capitalist Vinod Khosla will tell you, with cellulosic ethanol is lack of capital. Basically, capital is a coward, and the venture capitalists really want to know which horse to back rather than doing the whole diversified portfolio thing. Well, I suggested that DARPA, a Pentagon research agency that's very good at what are called fly-offs for competing military platforms, should simply take $500 million and build one of each of the 10 or 12 flavors of cellulosic ethanol plant whose processes are competing for capital and publish the numbers, and then we'll know what works how and what to invest in. That'll cut 10 years off the process.
You mentioned the savings and the potential for new kinds of industries in doing these kinds of things. This listener wants to know what happens to the jobs in the industries being obsoleted, if you will.
There are not very many jobs in the oil industry. There are a lot more jobs, upwards of 1 million directly and indirectly in automaking, and we need to consider very carefully whether we want to continue that industry's downward slide or revitalize it with advanced technology. I think the UAW is not the only force that would love to see that happen. But I think the shift of jobs will actually be a very healthy one, partly because the biofuel part of it will be centered in rural areas that have suffered a great population loss, don't have many good opportunities for the kids. That's our cultural anchor. I haven't seen many durable values come out of the suburbs lately.
So this listener mentions Iceland. Apparently they have an effort underway to adapt their energy needs towards hydrogen.
Yes.
What's your feeling?
Well, Iceland's a very interesting, unusual place. They're taking a unique approach to hydrogen, fitting their conditions, and they are one of about a half dozen places in the world that hopes to build an all-hydrogen economy, and they do have the wherewithal to do it. So keep a careful eye on that. There's no reason any other country couldn't do the same thing. And in a way, it doesn't matter whether you do or not. What matters is to use the energy very efficiently and use your local resources effectively, whatever they are. Hydrogen is just one way of doing that.
Right. Another technology that is being talked about as having great promise for displacing oil is solar and wind. How do those complement your ideas, and do they work together?
Well, in the existing energy system, no way of making electricity, whether it's solar, wind, or nuclear, has much to do with the oil problem. Only 2 or 3% of our electricity is made from oil, or of our oil makes electricity. Worldwide, the figure is only 7% overlap between oil and electricity. Therefore, when you displace electricity, you're not really saving oil, you're saving coal for the most part, which is a very good thing for the climate and for saving money, but it doesn't do much for the oil problem. You might suppose that, say, plug-in hybrids will change that equation because we'll be able to use off-peak electricity to displace oil for fairly short trips like commutes. This may be true. It is not yet clear that it's going to be an economically interesting proposition. It depends a lot on how cheap the batteries can get. But it also is going to require a smart grid, which we ought to have anyway for many reasons, including a resilient supply in the face of accident or malice. Broadly speaking, wind is the cheapest bulk source of electricity now, and the problem many people see that the wind doesn't always blow, the sun doesn't always shine, turns out to be a non-problem, even at very large scale, because these variable renewable resources can be diversified in what kinds you use and where they are. They can be forecast. This is called weather forecasting. We know a lot about that. And they can be integrated with the existing supply system and the existing demand patterns. So it turns out the amount of backup you need for wind power to be very reliable is less than the amount of backup we've already built and paid for to cope with the intermittence of our big thermal power plants, which fail 1,000 megawatts at a time unpredictably, usually for long periods. The renewables, properly done, are turning out to be the most attractive electricity option, and not just long run. This is, again, where the private capitalists are putting their money for good reason.
What about the military? They seem to be major users of energy. And do you see the potential in the military sector to the same degree you see in the private sector?
Yeah. I work a lot with the military on exactly this issue. They have this wonderfully teachable moment of being able to correlate the inefficiency of their vehicles and facilities with the number of fuel convoys that have to supply them and that get shot at and blown up. So they understand that just as the revolution in military affairs has been driven before by speed, stealth, precision, and networking, now it has to be driven by endurance, by the ability to keep operating for a long time over a big area affordably because you aren't dragging that heavy fuel logistics tail anymore. In the past, we have designed and bought the things that use fuel in the military on the assumption that the fuel delivery is free and invulnerable. We now know that's not true anymore, and that will have a huge effect on how we value military fuel efficiency as the most important thing we can do for warfighting objectives. But I would add the most important thing we can do not to have to fight so many wars because we won't care about oil anymore. So, you know, just imagine being able to treat countries with oil the same as countries without oil, or not giving others in the reason to suppose that everything this country does is about oil. That would be a much nicer world. And when Secretary Rice says that our oil dependence is warping our foreign policy, she's absolutely right, and we need to stop it.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our speaker today is Amory Lovins, co-founder and CEO of Rocky Mountain Institute. Unfortunately, we've reached the point in our program where there's just time for one last question, which is, what are the major impediments to implementing the ideas in your book, and what can an individual citizen do to help make it happen?
The biggest impediment, I think, is not realizing it's possible, not realizing that if we just do the kinds of things we've done before, wringing more work out of each barrel and letting our entrepreneurial genius work, one of the great strengths of this country, if we put the right pieces together in the right way, getting off oil can be much more profitable than using the stuff, assuming that all the hidden costs of getting and using the oil are worth zero, a conservatively low estimate. So I would go with the Raymond Williams remark that to be truly radical is to make hope possible, not despair convincing. Whether you're worried or not about how much oil there is or whether the climate is changing, or about our national security and job loss and so on related to oil, I think all of us as Americans can get behind sensible solutions implemented in a market economy, and therefore we need to educate ourselves at the individual level, in our communities, in our faith communities, wherever we are, our geographic communities, how to wring more work out of our oil. Those of you who are not driving a very efficient car know who you are. I get 62 miles a gallon. What do you get? And by the way, my commute to work is 10 meters.
All right. Our thanks to Amory Lovins, co-founder and CEO of Rocky Mountain Institute. We also thank our audiences here and on the radio. I'm Kerry Curtis, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.